Global Capital Podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the Global Capital Podcast. I'm Ralph Sinclair and I'm the Frequent Issuers Managing Editor at Global Capital.
And I'm John Hay, Corporate Finance and Sustainability Editor.
And I'm Mike Turner, Corporate Bonds Editor.
Okay, great. And coming up this week, we have a novel, or as cynics might say, yet another piece of sustainability-linked bond issuance to walk you through. That's from Nordea, the Helsinki-headquartered Nordic bank, which has issued a bond, the proceeds of which will fund its sustainability-linked loan book. We'll be asking our Deputy Bank Finance Editor, Frank Jackman, a little later about the deal, how good its ESG claims are, what it achieves, and who else in Helsinki might be preparing a similar deal. But first, in the sticking with the ESG world and something altogether less pleasant, keen listeners will remember we've talked quite a bit about Gabon's blue bond. It's not been a great week for Gabon, has it, Mike?
It has not. There's been a coup, a military coup, which came completely out of left field. No one expected it. And the bonds have reacted accordingly by selling off dramatically.
Yeah. Now, is the blue bond itself in any particular danger? Because, of course, that had an extra credit enhancement, didn't it?
Well, that ought to mean that it's in less danger than the other bonds. And in fact, its price has fallen less. And it's fair to say that the fall in Gabon's bond prices is not so far catastrophic. The 2031 bond, for example, that George Collard, our emerging market bonds reporter, looked at, had fallen 6 percentage points on the news to 75. And a month ago, there was a tender offer for it at 85. So, you know, it's obviously been hit, but it's not, people are not pricing in default at the moment.
No, I think probably a bit early to say, but it does, doesn't it, show the perils inherent in emerging market bond investing. So certainly a situation we'll be keeping an eye on here. Now, however, first, we wanted to let our beloved listeners know that unlike the previous Gabon administration, we're in it for the long haul. But rest assured, we're not here for a three-hour-long episode. What we mean is that we're going to be talking about how investors across a number of the bond markets that we cover at Global Capital are interested in long-dated bonds at the moment, and what this tells us about interest rates and what borrowers are doing about it. Now, you uncovered quite a lot of evidence of this in the corporate bond market this week. Mike, tell us what happened.
There's been a substantial increase in demand for long maturity bonds, and this can be seen really on a like-for-like basis. So we had a few deals this week that were multi-tranche, four tranches or two tranches, and the longer portion of those tranches were way much more in demand. One that really sticks out is NG because it pushed all the way to 19 years, which in the corporate bond market really is quite a very, you know, it's a very, very long bond. And the shortest tranche on its deal was 4 years. And the 19-year got like double the demand of the 4-year tranche and was bigger, and it flattened its 4 to 19-year curve, you know, accordingly, because it had more demand, so it could push harder on the pricing. But the real difference now is before the summer and for much of this year, investors have wanted duration, increasingly wanted duration, because they thought that rates would stop rising or perhaps even start falling. So this was like their chance to get in, right, before yields came down again. But now it's much more a case of investors have been sort of battered into submission and they have to accept that higher for longer rates are here. So, you know, they have to sort of plan accordingly for that because they still want long duration bonds. They need it as part of their portfolios. So they kind of have to accept that this is where the world is.
So they have to accept that rates might keep going up and they might lose money.
Might lose out, exactly. Bonds. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So there's very little consensus as to where spreads are going for the rest of the year, for example. ABN AMRO did a survey of their sort of investor clients to try and get a handle on it, and there was really no agreement among investors, which is good because that makes a market, right? That means that you find demand in different places and things like that. But it also means that some people are going to lose money because they're going to buy these things and then spreads are going to widen.
So that's advantage issuers then, isn't it, really, if they can start doing long-dated funding and essentially cajole investors into buying it, surely?
It is, to a degree, but we're in this sort of uneasy place in the markets at the moment where we're in this state of flux and also this prospect of potential recession or, you know, further rate rises if inflation gets bigger again or energy crisis. All these things mean it's not an easy time to be a corporate now, whereas the last 10 years have been a very easy time to be a corporate because you can always just get cheap money. So yes, you can lock in long maturity funding, but if you only come to the market once or twice a year and you lock in 20-year funding, great, but that 20-year funding now has like double the yield of your previous bonds that you printed a couple of years ago, then suddenly your overall cost of funding has shot up quite significantly.
You've also locked that in for 20 years.
Yeah, exactly.
So you are taking a view on interest rates and basically betting that it's worth it, even though we might go into another trough of interest rates for another 10 years.
Yeah, exactly. So that's why it's a very specific type of borrower who can really benefit from this. And it's the sort of borrower who comes multiple times a year, does big tranches, has a massive debt pile, because if you get this, say, 20-year bond that charges a much higher yield, even if rates go against you and, you know, things become very cheap again in terms of debt, it doesn't overall to your entire debt profile, it makes a much smaller difference than if you're a much smaller issuer with a smaller debt profile. So you can kind of suck it up a bit. And not only can you suck it up a bit, but you can also presumably refinance your other debt to be cheaper. So you can sort of work it out in that way.
Now, September is always one of the more exhilarating months in the primary bond market because investors have a ton more cash to put to work, and it's traditionally one of the high points for issuance. So what does that mean for the immediate future of corporate borrowers, Mike? Are we about to see, you know, a lot more long-dated deals over this month? Because the corporate bond market is kind of interesting, isn't it? It's one of those ones that can run out of steam quite quickly.
Yeah, so this week has been rampant. It's been a short week. Monday was off in terms of deals because the UK was off for a bank holiday, and it's been very, very busy. But already by Thursday, so Friday is generally a fallow day that doesn't really get issuance. You know, you might get one or two. But Thursday, already by then, deals have started to slow down because so much had come the previous 2 days. And next week is the sort of big open week in September because there's no bank holiday like there was this week. And the following week is a sort of crunch meeting at the European Central Bank, which will, you know, issuance will sort of revolve around that and be affected by that. So next week is expected to be busy. And there is definitely a sense that if issuers weren't planning to do longer dated bonds, but they are these big issuers who have the sort of capacity and the ability to do so, they will be looking to sort of, you know, see what they can do with their curve and seeing if it's worthwhile. Because even though prices have gone up so much for borrowers and, you know, yields have gone up, it's still, on a historical basis, it's still, you know, average to low. We're not in huge yields yet at all.
No.
So it's you know, people can take advantage of it.
I don't remember the corporate bond market getting going quite this volume in the sort of end of summer. Do you, Mike?
The last couple of years have sort of been, don't count, because they've been aberrations because of the work from home trend. But yeah, so before this week, there was a sort of spate of deals last week, and they definitely came earlier than I would have expected. But they all went really well. They all got big demand and small new issue premiums and all the things that issuers want from their deals. And, you know, you look at the FIG market's been pumping out deals through nearly all of August, and that's pretty closely correlated to the corporate bond market. You know, if the FIG market's going well, generally corporate bond market is also going well. So I think it's been a case of just issuers are, you know, it takes some bravery, right? Because if you're going to come in the middle of August and your deal doesn't work, then you look like an idiot and your bosses think you're an idiot. You know, why not just come in September when everyone knows they're spending money? So, you know, it does take some bravery, and there just wasn't that in abundance, I guess, which makes sense because, you know, we're on a knife edge with so many things.
Yeah, it's been an interesting parallel with the SSA bond market, I think. Last week, similar to the corporate bond market, seemed to be a sort of full-throated revival of issuance after the summer. There were something like 22 billion euros worth of benchmark bonds issued across dollars and euros. But people thought it was all a bit lackluster, which was surprising. It's usually a market that's all but guaranteed to, you know, excite, thrill and delight in equal measure in September. And then this week, there was only 3.5 billion euros of benchmark issuance in euros from just two deals. And this led to one of those sorts of interesting pleas that you get sometimes in the SSA market, where a number of participants all sort of start asking for certain borrowers, like the big sort of hefty borrowers, to, and I quote, show leadership. What that usually means is we need someone to sell a bond on the cheap to settle everyone else down. And again, it's this trend for long-dated assets that's also mixed in with this. There was a long-dated deal this week from Germany, which did a 3 billion euro increase of its of one of its bunds maturing in 2053. That attracted orders of about 22 billion euros. The only other deal in euros this week was a four-year deal from Comuninvest that was a sub-benchmark size. It was only 500 million euros. So I think that the bankers that Georgie Lee, our SSA reporter, spoke to about this insist that, and I think the Germany deal proves their point, they insist that there is demand for long-dated deals. But they also complain that the borrowers that have come have just tried to push pricing a little bit too much. And that's why some of the deals have not been quite as thrilling as they might think.
I wonder as well how much read over there is from anything Germany does in the market, because it's such a standalone issuer.
Well, indeed. Yeah, that's true. That's very true. I mean, you've got to think there's always going to be large structural demand for bunds, and a bund syndication as well, which is where you probably get slightly more of a premium than if you buy the things in auction. And of course, you don't get a premium at all if you're buying them in the secondary market.
One thing that has come up in my conversations with people, not just in the corporate bond market, actually across a couple of markets, is how real money investors are now coming back to public fixed income. And I wonder if that's also happening in SSAs, because of where yields have risen to. So you may as well go to these bigger, more liquid bonds now, where you can get the returns that you need to hit your mandate. And you can also sell your position if you need to quite easily.
Yes.
To such big, in inverted commas, safe markets.
Yeah, no, I think we've seen evidence, plenty of evidence of that this year. And also people in the SSA market have the same view on where we are with interest rates that they do in the corporate bond market, as you described earlier.
Real money is you know, stuff like pension funds, insurance funds, and people who have a natural need for very long duration.
Yeah. Yeah, and they're waiting for issuers that have a natural need to issue this long-dated stuff. And who they're talking about in particular, to name names, is they're anticipating the first syndication from the EU, which is due for the week of September the 11th. Now, the EU has, I think it was aiming for a sort of an average duration of its benchmark funding of 15 years. It's a borrower with an absolutely huge program, and it does tend to, quote unquote, demonstrate leadership because it has so much to borrow. It usually has to pay up a little bit more, perhaps, than some borrowers do. And because it's doing so much funding, other borrowers tend to stay out of its way until it's done. But also, you know, they're talking about other sovereign syndications from other European governments. Again, governments tend to want to issue longer dated debt. And so we might see some of those next week too, which will give us much more of a clue about whether the SSA market is going to have a bounteous September or not.
I think as well, there is a degree of the second half is not going to be as busy as the first half across multiple markets, because funding needs just aren't there in the same way they were at the start of the year. And, you know, then stuff just thinking about corporates, for example, publicly announced M&A transactions, which, you know, provide a lot of funding. Caring this week, for example, provided one of the biggest deals in months, and that was linked to M&A. But just the nature of how long they take to pass through the market and then require funding from the bond market means that it probably won't happen this year. So, you know, that's a significant portion of big funding that won't happen. So I think the second half is going to be much quieter than the first.
Yeah, and in the SSA market, we know that a lot of issuers went out early this year to try and get as much done as they could at the start. And a number of borrowers are very well advanced in their funding programs. KfW, for example, the German policy bank, this week reached 84% done. You know, it's planning a few more benchmark outings because it likes to be a regular, reliable issuer in these markets, but it is nonetheless 84% done with its program already. And that's, you know, it's reasonably characteristic of a lot of SSA issuers.
And I wonder how much of so the ECB meeting next week is, you know, is really quite an important meeting, because things like inflation is now hitting forecasts. It's not hitting the targets the ECB needs, not hitting the 2% or thereabouts target, but it's hitting forecasts and it's coming down and it looks like it's getting more controlled. So if you are a regular issuer like in the SSA market and you're thinking about pre-funding, you might put that off until next year and you know, not pre-fund as much, because if inflation is coming down, then it looks like rates might be coming down as well. So you have to make that call, and that's a call that they haven't had to make for a long time.
Although that really only affects the fixed rate SSA borrowers, like the governments and the EU and people who care about the fixed rate of funding. For the banks ones, which is all the agencies and supranationals, they're focused purely on spread. So it's all about timing the market for when there's optimal demand.
And you do have to wonder, I mean, SSAs don't generally pre-fund as a rule, but you do wonder if, if central banks do have to start sort of tempering their rate increases, they might be worried about recession. And recession tends to drive demand for SSA bonds because you suddenly get an investor flight to quality because people start worrying about credit quality and things like that, which is not really a concern in the SSA market.
So talking about the bond market firing on all cylinders at this time of year, it was interesting this week to see an innovative deal come to the market, which is not something that typically happens in August, and that was from Nordea. So we're going to be hearing from Frank Jackman about that in a moment.
Good morning, Frank. Welcome back to the podcast.
Morning, Ralph. Thanks for having me.
Now, you've written about a piece of sustainability-linked financing that was certainly novel last year, but is now the issuer is attempting to take it mainstream. And that issuer is Nordea, which is the Helsinki-headquartered Nordic lender. Tell us what they've done, first of all.
Well, it's an innovative way of funding their sustainability-linked loan book. So they basically issued a use of proceeds bond, with the use of proceeds are earmarked for issuing or for funding their SLL loan book. So as you mentioned, they did it first last year in their local markets, Norwegian krona, Swedish krona. But this week they went significantly larger and hit the euro market, took €1 billion, and everyone seemed to have loved it. And there's a lot of buzz around that across the market.
Okay, so how do we categorize this product then? Because it's not a sustainability-linked bond in itself, is it? Because it's not sort of governed by the KPIs that are typical of the sustainability-linked loans and funds, but it's probably not a green bond either, is it? Because, of course, companies that take out sustainability-linked loans can do anything with the money, and you know, they could perfectly legitimately use the funds to go and bulldoze half the Amazon or, you know, whatever they choose to do. Not that we're suggesting that Nordea would lend to a business like that, of course.
Exactly. It's not an ESG bond in the sense that it's got a green or social asset pool. It's not a sustainability-linked bond, which, I know, as a bank, Nordea would have issues issuing given the presence of sort of step-up, step-down coupon. But what it is, it's a way of allowing investors to get exposure to the sustainability-linked loan book. So Nordea does lending to these companies. So there's 13 that they're lending to in the asset pool. And these companies are obviously, they want to do something more sustainable. They've tied their lending, their borrowing to their sort of internal KPIs related to climate change mitigation.
So Frank, you said the market liked the deal, but have you got any more details? Did ESG-minded investors like it?
Yeah, so I don't know the exact breakdown of the ESG investors within the book, but it got €2 billion book. The issuer told me that the SLL label definitely helped in terms of attracting that demand. It was, yeah, about two-thirds going to asset managers and about a third went to France, which was partly the French investors were buying it in part because of the SLL features. You know, there was definitely interest from accounts that there was about 125 involved in the trade, very little sensitivity in the book, and they were able to price with a tight new issue premium.
So this doesn't fall into either of the main categories of green issuance. It's not a green bond, as you explained, and it's not a sustainability-linked bond. So it's sort of something different. But investors that like environmental, social and governance type instruments, they tend to be quite fussy. They have likes and dislikes. How did Nordea sort of try to satisfy that or kind of convince people that this was a safe deal?
Yes, so it seemed to my calls yesterday that there are, of course, as you mentioned, investors that are very rigid with their mandates. They can only buy green bonds, they can only buy social bonds. But for those that maybe are a little bit more flexible, you know, it seems people are saying that it's been feeling that there is a shift in the market compared to less about the label, is what someone said, and more about what the underlying projects are. Does someone really want to be, like, if you're investing in a green bond and it's just invested in the use of proceeds are green office blocks, you know, it's people are starting to look at that. Do they want to be invested in that, or do they want to be invested in something where they're actually making a sort of an impact, where, you know, you've got in the instance of, or in the SLL bond this week, you know, the paper or the underlying loans are for companies that are trying to make a difference in terms of their sustainability or climate change mitigation KPIs and trying to meet.
But surely that runs up against the fact that traditional green bonds, I mean, they are making a difference by definition because they're building projects that are green. So the types of buyers in this, Are they just like regular bond buyers who want to feel a bit better about themselves, presumably, and not sort of dedicated ESG funds?
It was predominantly asset managers picking it up, but there was definitely an element of sustainability-minded investors in there. But to the extent of how many are in there, I'm not too sure. It was ultimately, it's a bank senior non-preferred bond, and it will attract investors that want to buy bank senior non-preferred paper. It doesn't necessarily fit into a green or social or sustainability linked mandate, but for anyone that maybe is a little bit more flexible, this was an interesting product that they could pick up and add to the mix.
So I think then that this is potentially a good thing for the sustainability linked loan market, because, and I'm not at all saying that Nordea is involved in this, but there's been a degree of banks, lending banks, using this and making it up like bandits by pretending they're doing something sustainability linked related, when in fact they're not at all. By, and the way they do this is by giving companies the ability to sign these loans and to put out press releases saying they've signed these sustainability linked loans. But because it's a private market, they haven't actually come up with any KPIs. So it's just a loan that they've just put a headline on it saying it's sustainability linked, without any of the sort of green or social targets that are needed in the bond market. So hopefully by this becoming a bond product now and something that is looked at by 100 odd investors rather than just a handful of lending banks with relationships, it will make the loan market become a bit more focused and a bit more sort of accountable in its sustainability linked loans.
I think Nordea has sort of negated that to an extent, and that sort of vagueness of the SLL market, by they're going to publish an SLL funding report in the same way that you get a green bond asset report for a green bond program. So every year they're going to update investors on the progress made by the underlying borrowers in terms of meeting their KPIs. And they actually printed the first report, came out last week, which was tied to the loans that were in the debut issue last year.
Great. So that's exactly what I was talking about, really, because then that gives automatic accountability, doesn't it? It means they have to sign loans where the KPIs are in place, and the KPIs then have to be reported on, rather than some of the loans that I've seen where there's no KPIs at all. That just wouldn't float with these investors.
And Frank, they can't just put any loan into the structure, can they?
No. So the loans do have to meet certain criteria. So of course they've got to meet the SLL principles, be aligned with that. You know, the key criteria is they've got to contribute to one of the sort of climate change mitigation objectives that the bank has come up with, and the KPIs must be material and there must be ambitious SPTs. And actually Nordea has, in its investor presentation, it did put out a case study of three companies that it has loaned to and that will be part of the framework or part of the asset pool. Probably the one that's most known to your average listener would be Pandora, which makes plenty of little tiny trinkets and jewelry, and they're aiming to become carbon neutral in terms of reducing their scope 1 and scope 2 emissions. And that's something that they have been working on, and that's something that they have now tied into a bond and tied into their loans, which have now been fed into this bond issue that people bought this week.
Now, there must be something in the water in Helsinki, because another institution that's considering these sorts of deals, which we know about from actually, if anyone who read our Supranationals roundtable that was published over the summer, just half hour walk away is the Nordic Investment Bank. What are they up to, Frank? They seem to be working on a similar deal. Is that right?
Yeah, I don't know if maybe working on a similar deal, it might be too early to say that, but they're very excited about the idea. You know, I spoke to some of the funding and IR team yesterday, and yeah, they have an SLL book and they're looking to find a way to finance that. You know, they've had an SLL book for just over 2 years when they signed a small loan with Electrolux, which makes washing machines amongst other things. And they've now got 650 million euro equivalent loan portfolio that they want to fund. And I think the thing that they're working on, and they've been discussing as a executive committee member of the principals at ICMA, is setting up a working group to explore the topic a bit more. You know, you've got Nordea has, of course, it's the trailblazer. They've done two transactions now across three tranches. But yeah, the NIB wants to sort of explore that further, and they want to get the whole market talking, not so much just people phoning up Nordea's funding team and asking them what they want to do or what they did. They want to get people sat down in the same room discussing, what are we doing? How do we do this? How can we make sure that what we're doing is harmonized across issuers? You don't want to have FIG issuers going one way, SSA issuers going the other. it's still early days for the product. You know, even then, it's still early days for SLLs. But yeah, there definitely seems to be some excitement, and the NIB seems to be sort of blazing the way, along with Nordea, for this sort of product.
And what about other SSA issuers? Because SSA, the SSA market is, of course, where you know, the green bond market certainly was born. It's less usual, I would say, to see a sort of new type of product go from the bank finance market to the SSA market. Are other SSA issuers also looking at this sort of SLL funding instrument?
Yeah, it is a bit of a split in interest. I think ultimately you do need an SLL portfolio, and that's probably why, one of the reasons why this maybe came from the bank sector first, because banks, of course, are probably, they're lending more. They know that's what they are at the end of the day. But yeah, there's a bit of hesitancy amongst some funding officials. You know, someone, a large European SSA borrower, told us that actually they prefer green bonds, you know, the more established product. But as an issuer, they might prefer green bonds, but they do accept that, you know, this is a useful product and it makes sense for investors to have a wider range of choice, and also for issuers to have a wider range of funding products in which to finance their lending.
I suspect with SSAs as well, just the nature of their ownership structure, they have to be sort of, you know, greener than green when it comes to these things. So it's probably easier for them all round to just do, you know, they're very easy to describe green bond.
Yes, yeah. And I think as well, the mandates for a bank in terms of the lending is going to be significantly larger than, say, an SSA that might have a more focused approach, be it on one sector or one type of borrower or type of lender, sorry. So a bank, of course, a lot broader. SSAs, a bit more narrow in terms of where and who they're lending to.
So apart from the publicity benefits that always follow a new type of ESG-themed issuance, what was the point of this deal for Nordea? Was there a pricing advantage in terms of what it paid for the funding?
No. They paid about 8 basis points concession. You know, they paid, I think they told me, about 2 to 5 basis points of greenium on their green bonds, but there was no, they didn't crystallize a pricing benefit here. I think part of that might be, and one of the things I discussed with a few other people this week, is that you don't suddenly want to add a whole other curve. You know, Nordea's got a green curve, it's got a conventional curve. You don't want to slap an SLL curve in there and start to sort of muddy the waters just yet. But ultimately, for Nordea, and the treasurer told me that their main objective was to offer investors more transparency over the use of proceeds, which you can take it as you want, but their intention was, yeah, we're doing this product, we've got this thing that we want to finance, we're going to do it this way, and in exchange we're going to give investors a bit more clarity over where their money is going. And maybe there isn't the pricing benefit, but I think there is definitely a benefit and an interest in the product, and maybe we'll see a pricing benefit if it takes off.
So I wonder if it's very popular among banks, and this isn't Nordea at all, but it's very popular among banks to say how much ESG projects they're going to finance. And they come out with these huge numbers. Many, many banks have done this. And so occasionally when you dig into it, it seems a bit less clear than it might seem, such as, for example, when I was saying about them financing sustainability-linked loans, which don't have KPIs attached to them. That still goes in that pot of ESG things they finance. Right, so I wonder if a bond like this might be a helpful way for some enterprising jobber at a bank to work out a way to make it look like they finance more ESG than they actually have, because you could, you know, effectively double it up, right? The loans that you've done, and then also this ESG-linked bond that you've raised could also go into that pool.
Well, I think that transparency that Nordea seemingly want to offer is key, isn't it? And it's going to come down to investors demanding that level of transparency from an issuer. I mean, I guess there's always a risk, isn't there, that everyone wants the publicity benefits of being seen to invest in ESG-related projects. And so there is, at the more cynical end of the market, a mutual interest in a lack of transparency. But you would hope that credible investors would demand that.
And that's what would worry me about this bond, because it doesn't fit into ESG portfolios strictly. You get rid of that level of, the green guys need to know it's green because otherwise it won't go in their funds and they'll get in trouble for having it in there. You know, whereas the sort of layman funds that just buy it and, oh, look, it's nice to have this, they will probably, because they're less regulated to do so, they'll be far less strict on the way they analyse the ESG credentials.
Yeah. I mean, what do you think, John? Do you think this is the sort of product where there's an instant need for market-wide standards, or should issuers just find their feet themselves and investors will vote accordingly?
Well, it's interesting that Frank reported that the Nordic Investment Bank are already keen to sort of push for there to be a working group on it, that the Green Bond Principles Organization, to sort of develop standards for it, which indicates, you know, first of all, their degree of enthusiasm and how much the market likes there to be kind of agreed standards. But I think it is interesting that really the sort of apparent popularity of this and the interest that Frank has discovered in the market for this, because, you know, this is not revolutionary. No one should kid themselves that this is going to change anything on the ground in industry or sort of accelerate the transition or anything like that. These loans are being made. This is a bond that is linked to them. They were financed before. You know, nothing really material has changed. But I think Mike's point is interesting and is really the heart of it, that there is a possibility that if this is certainly good for the image of the sustainability-linked loan market, which has had a bit of a pasting. And I think if it can be made more sort of pucker and get a better and more public image, and issuers like Nordea that use this product will definitely have criteria, like as Nordea has done, to include them in the pools. And I think that could help to include, you know, sort of raise standards in the SLL market and, you know, above all, sort of give the product a fresh push.
Well, to see how widely Nordea's sustainability-linked loan funding tool is adopted across SSA and bank markets, be sure to follow globalcapital.com and listen to this podcast, which is out every Friday. You'll also be able to follow, of course, how the rest of the autumn plays out for bond issuers. It only remains for me to thank Mike, John and Frank for joining me for this edition of the podcast, and to thank you, the listeners, for tuning in. So until next week, thank you very much for listening and goodbye.